There's not an opening chant, is there? There used to be. I'm living in the past. Good morning, everyone. We used to do an opening the sutra chant and a closing the sutra chant. Now we just do the closing, the bodhisattva vows. But I was just at Hokyoji last week, was it? About a couple of weeks ago, and we did the opening and the closing chant there. So good to see you. Hello, everyone. On this warm summer day, it's good to be together. So today my talk is going to be about on some of the teaching stories of Dongshan, who's one of our ancestors in our lineage, Chan, Chinese ancestors. And he's in the list that we chant here on Saturdays. We chant the list of the ancestors, and that's done all over in Soto Zen places all over the world, honoring the ancestors. And many of our teachings from Dogen reference these earlier teachings and these of earlier masters. And the first one I'm going to talk about is no exception. So I was inspired to talk about Dongshan today because at Hokyoji we just had a sesshin called Formal Retreat with the theme of the jewel mirror samadhi. And that's a teaching poem. It's called Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. It's a teaching poem of Dongshan's, which sums up his teaching. So that's what we studied there, and I'm not going to talk about that today. But it was inspiring, very inspiring. So going to talk a little bit about his early life and Soto Zen, which is what we do here. It's our tradition. It's our lineage. Is one of the five schools of Zen from China, and it's one of two that are remaining from those times, Linji and Kaodong. Kaodong is the Chinese name for Soto, and it's. It's supposed to be a combination of Dongshan's name and his student's name. So Kaodong is Kaoshan. Benji was Dongshan's student. And in Japanese, let's see, what are their names in Japanese? Okay, Tozan Ryokai. Sozan, I think Sozan Chimon is the other one. So Soto, it came up with that combination for Soto Zen. And Dogen studied with Rujing, his teacher, and we're studying Dogen here with Tim on Wednesday nights. So Dogen studied with a Kaodong teacher in China called Rujing. So there's a little background. And so now we sit here with this, thanks to the effort and compassion of a great Dogen fan and Dongshan fan, Katagiri Roshi. So reciting the names of the ancestors and doing that repeatedly and also studying koan cases and stories are ways that we learn Dharma today. And the way that we see how some of these ancient stories and teachings are still alive today. They're still alive. So, and we're going to do that next weekend with Norm Fisher. There's a workshop where he's going to cover some of the koans from the Book of Serenity. So I hope that some of you will come to that. So the Book of Serenity is a Soto collection of koan cases and stories. And I know if you've never read koans, but you've heard about them, they might seem kind of daunting. You know, when we first read these stories, when I first read them, I was just like, eh, I don't get it. And my first impression was to make up an excuse for myself, like, well, we're Soto. Koans are Rinzai, right? So let's put this aside and read something else, you know, read some sutras. But actually, that's a misconception, because we do study koans in Soto Zen. We do it in a little different way. We kind of immerse ourselves in them. And we also have, as in Dogen's teaching, our Genjo koan, which is the koan of our life, our individual life, our existence. What is it? What is it? So actually Dogen encountered the Blue Cliff Record when he was in China, and he copied it by hand and brought it back to Japan. And there were just a few hand copies. There was a teacher, and I forgot his name, who had burned the first copy of the Blue Cliff Record because he thought people were getting too caught up in the ideas and not just being with just this, you know. But there were some copies that survived, thankfully. And now we can get multiple copies. You can get a copy in the library downstairs or on Amazon for really cheap. We might be a bit embarrassed by our inability to understand koans at first, you know. So we have to approach them a little bit less directly, not like we read most conventional teachings, and just sit with them, discuss them with other people, contemplate them, read different commentaries. And it's so easy to get commentaries online now of different koans. You can just go in and Google the name of the case and find a Dharma talk somewhere, a transcript that will give you one view of usually a fairly seasoned teacher. So that's a fun way to, it's actually more accessible now, in other words, than it was when I started out to read koans. So these stories are about direct encounters between two awakened beings, or between an awakened and an awakening being. Who knows? But that's the point, is that the monk goes to the teacher and asks a question and has a burning desire to know this answer. It's something that they're carrying around with them. And so I don't know how many really direct encounters you've had in life with a teacher, with another being, possibly with an animal, you know. I think it's easier for people now to have a feeling of direct contact and communion with, say, their dog or another animal. I really liked Ted's story in the latest newsletter about his and Kathy's camping or hiking trip where they encountered a ram, a huge animal, on this talus, this really flaky rock. And his description of what he did instinctively, his first thing was to stand in front of Kathy and protect her. I thought that was really sweet. But also, and it was a direct encounter, there were no words involved. It was quite powerful. And his description of this ram just looking right at them calmly, almost like looking through them. And someone got it on camera, another hiker, and sent them the pictures and the photos in the newsletter article if you want to read it. But that was a really lovely description of a direct encounter beyond words with a non-human being. So sometimes in these cases, there'll be shouts, you know. The teacher might let out a shout that could just startle, you know, his student. The monk's response is to immediately shout back, you know, with no hesitation. There's those. Then there's the hitting with a slipper and the blows and then dissolving into raucous laughter. Those are the hardest for us to understand, but you know, it's kind of like, you know, if you're really close to someone, a friend of mine down at Hokkyoji, to say goodbye, he socked me on the arm, said, "See ya." I was a little taken aback, but it's kind of like that, you know, when you're really close friends with someone. When you're intimate with someone, whether it's friends, student-teacher isn't always friends, but it's an intimate relationship, then there's a response that just meets the response and can dissolve into gales of laughter. So you see that. So we don't get it, but it makes sense. So action beyond conventionally polite standards often shows up in the stories. Ways to demonstrate understanding without using words. And they also employ turning phrases and verses, and there's commentaries. So that's all part of it. So today I'm going to read a story, a little encounter that I wrote down of Dongshan, out on pilgrimage looking for a teacher that can help him with some burning questions. And he was very young when he started studying Buddhism. He started with a fairly unknown teacher, was ordained, I think, even before he was 20, on the famous Mount Song in China, and immediately began his pilgrimage from teacher to teacher. And back in those days, there wasn't competition, you know, between teachers. They would often recommend you go see someone else if they couldn't help you with your burning question. That was very common. And there was this riches of famous masters at a certain time, all within, you know, certainly it was a hard trek, but within trekking distance of each other, there was a cluster of monasteries in southern China. So as we go through this, I'm going to ask you some questions. I'm just going to throw out some questions for you to think about, and then I hope we can discuss at the end. I can repeat them at the end. So this burning desire, here's a few questions for you. What would be the equivalent to actions such as those beyond words, beyond speaking and reading for our time today? How much do we truly want to wake up from the painful separation of our dualistic tendency to see me over here and you over there, self and other, that separation? What are we willing to do in that regard? Are we willing to see and use everyday ordinary activities as opportunities to wake up? Are we willing to make zazen, sitting, meditation practice, the most important thing we do on a day-to-day basis? How can we realize and demonstrate the reality of non-separation in our activities with the things that we use and encounter and with people, relationships? So those are the questions, and now you can forget them. So these ancient teachers like Shitu, who's we have wrote Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage and the Merging of Difference and Unity, and Ben has a book of commentary, a lovely book out about that. And Dongshan, who is Shitu's Dharma grandson in that lineage, and later Dogen, were able to awaken, and through their great commitment to sharing the Dharma, having pity on all sentient beings, we have the teachings today. So we're We're very lucky. So Dongshan lived from 807 to 69 in the Tang Dynasty. He came from ancient Huiji, which is modern Zhejiang province, according to Andy Ferguson, who's an American student of Tenshin Reb Anderson, and he also wrote this book that is a great reference for books, for stories about Zen, the old Zen masters. It's basically just the encounters themselves and very little commentary. That's a wonderful book. He's a good scholar. So the story of his youth relates that his very first teacher, he heard the Heart Sutra. And I don't know if any of you remember, those of you who've been around for a while, what you thought the first time you heard the Heart Sutra. But what he said, when he came to this, he said to his teacher, "No eyes, no ears, no tongue, no body. I have eyes, ears, and a nose, etc." So why does the Heart Sutra say there is none? On the basis of that, his first teacher said, "I can't be your teacher. You're too smart for me." So he sent him to his next teacher. He was ordained at 21, took his monk's vows. Oh, for Dongshan, by the way, this pilgrimage was his total lifestyle way of life. You know, most people in the stories would do it for a number of years, but I think he did it for 30 or 40 years. Before he settled down, he was older before he settled down and became a teacher and had students, was an abbot, and old means like my age, you know, which doesn't feel old to me. Okay, so the first person he visited was Nanchuan. Some of you know who that is, some of you don't. It doesn't matter, he's a famous Zen master. And Nanchuan was a disciple of Matsu, or Master Ma, a famous, powerful, strong Chan master who was a contemporary, direct contemporary, although they didn't really interact much with Shi Tu in China. And at the time, Master Ma was preparing a feast in honor of his departed teacher, Ma. So Dongshan showed up in the assembly, and Nanchuan asked the monks, "Do you think Ma will show up for this feast?" Dongshan stepped forward and he said, "If he has a companion, he will, or a good companion." And so that meant, you know, if he has a worthy student, he'll appear. So he's signaling Nanchuan. So Nanchuan says to him, because he's looking for a teacher, right? "I'm a worthy student." And Nanchuan says, "I think there might be a trainable monk here." And Dongshan says, "Don't crush what shouldn't be crushed." Apparently he didn't like the idea of being molded and trained. He was an intense guy, so he left. He didn't stay with Nanchuan. And he traveled further to Guishan, another famous Zen master. He went to visit him. There he did stay a while, and one day he asked him about something that was puzzling him. "Dongshan, I've heard that national teacher Huizong," he was a national teacher because he taught three emperors at the time, "taught that inanimate beings expound the Dharma. I don't understand this." So there was apparently some debate in China about whether inanimate beings, such as rocks, tiles, walls, fences, had Buddha nature. And it was decided that, yes, well, those items have Buddha nature. But I don't know if it was decided at this time, and it got to Dongshan. He really had a burning question in his heart about that. So he then tells Guishan this story he he heard about a monk who asks a national teacher about this, and he ends with this question: what scripture teachings about inanimate beings expounding the Dharma are there? And the national teacher says, obviously, this is not found in the scriptures, nor is it something that some noble one said. But haven't you heard the words of the Flower Garland Sutra that say, the Chiliocosm, sentient beings, and the three realms all proclaim it? So I don't know what the Chiliocosm is. I think it's like the universe, you know, some beyond what we can imagine model of the universe. Like a kalpa is an unimaginable amount of time in these Buddhist scriptures. I have this teaching, Guishan says, but one seldom encounters a person who understands it. So Dongshan says, I'm not clear about it. I ask you for your instruction about this. And Guishan lifts up his whisk. A whisk is like a horsehair object that is used primarily ceremonially by abbots of monasteries. I don't think we have a whisk here, but they certainly have one at Rinpoche. And it's used for high ceremonies and ordinations. But for a master like Guishan, it's just the closest thing. It'd be like me saying, do you see it? Holding this up, you know. So it's an ordinary object. Let's see. So Dongshan says, I don't understand. Please explain it to me, Master. Guishan says, the mouth which my parents gave to the world is utterly unable to explain this to you. Dongshan said, is there anyone else of your generation who can explain this to me? He probably didn't say it right, just like that. So Guishan says, you can find a man of the way in Yu County in a series of stone huts that are strung together. If you can bear his teaching methods, then you'll surely hold him in esteem. His name is Yunyan. So Dongshan says, thank you very much. And Shri bows and he leaves. And he goes to Yunyan, who lives in a cave, actually. He's not a teacher with his own place. He lives in a series. Those stone cottages, it's actually a cave. And he relates the story about the national teacher again and asks, who can hear inanimate beings expound the Dharma? Yunyan says, what is inanimate can hear it. So that's like the first level of kind of a conventional answer, right? Because it's like can hear like. Dongshan said, does the master hear it or not? And Yunyan said, if I could hear it, you wouldn't be able to hear me speak the Dharma. Why wouldn't I hear you? Why couldn't I? Dongshan asks. Yunyan held up his whisk and said, can you still hear me or not? Dongshan says, I can't hear you. Yunyan said, when I expound Dharma, you can't hear me. So how could you hear it when inanimate beings proclaim it? And Dongshan says, he asks, what scripture teaches about inanimate beings expounding the Dharma? Again, he asks. You know, so both stories have the whisk. Both stories have him asking for this confirmation. Like, where is it in the teaching? And aren't we like that too? We want to know what the sources are for this, these claims. We want to know where it is, in what scripture. So Guishan says, haven't you seen in the Amitabha Sutra? It says, the lakes and rivers, the birds, the forests, they all chant Buddha, they all chant Dharma. Upon hearing this, Dongshan experienced a great insight. He then wrote the verse that's on your programs. How incredible, how incredible. Inanimate beings proclaiming the Dharma is inconceivable. It can't be known if the ears try to hear it. But when the eyes hear it, it may be known. So here we see him, right? He struggles to understand something that's beyond words. And he talks about hearing with the eyes when he awakens suddenly and understands this. He talks about hearing with the eyes. Speaking causes him to miss the point. And that's one of Guishan's points, which Dokai brought up at Hokyoji. Another quote from him, when he's asked about whether he hears the Dharma of non-sentient beings, he says, "Only when I don't speak can I hear it." So he's not really being a tough guy. He's saying, "Yeah, well, I can't hear it when I'm talking either, you know." So in order to have an experience of the non-sentient expressing reality, is another way to say it. Expounding the Dharma is just a term for expressing reality, which we are all doing all the time. We can't really help it, you know, in a way. I mean, that's, it's kind of like we all have Buddha nature, but still, we still have to practice so we can skillfully and wholeheartedly express it in a way so sentient beings can hear that. So here's a passage. I'm going to read you a passage about Avalokiteshvara. It's from the Blue Cliff Record. And let's see. So the eyes that hear the Dharma are the eyes on Kuan Yin's thousand hands. She's said to have a lot of hands, and they all have eyes on them. That's part of her lore, or his lore. But in China, she's female, called Kuan Yin. So this is from case 89 in the Blue Cliff Record. Yunyan, who's Dongshan's teacher, says, "I say that all over the body are hands and eyes." Dao Wu answers, "Brother, you have only 80% of it. Throughout the body are hands and eyes." So this is interesting. The cry regarder, which is another name for Avalokiteshvara, hears the cries of the world. And what helps her hear the cries of the world, or him? These hands, these eyes in the hands and the eyes through the body. So in ancient China, apparently, eyes were seen as organs. The eye is a symbol of intuitive understanding. And the ears are more connected to the left brain activity. So we wouldn't think that today, right? And I found this interesting. I actually didn't know about this until I studied a little bit for the class. And this is a little book by, it's a book by, called Receiving the Marrow, Teachings on Dogen by Soto Zen Women Priests. And I'll just read this little passage from Jisho Carrie Warner on this case. "There are eyes and ears on every oak leaf. There is a singing tongue and a hand on every twig. We notice colorful blossoms so that we think that's the flower's song. We get infatuated with shiny things, just like crows, but the bark and cambium and duff and stems and the mycorrhizal communities of roots and fungi are singing as subtly and as skillfully as the blue and purple blossoms. Throughout the body of the universe are hands and eyes, ours included." So to experience, to have an experience of non-sentient beings, their aliveness, the way they proclaim the Dharma without speaking, by just being, is often life-changing. And it's something that people have sometimes in childhood. I remember a time when I think I was around four, but I remember walking in prairie grasses near my grandmother's home that were as tall as I was. And I recovered this memory later in adulthood. I think we forget. In adolescence, we forget things, you know, young adulthood. But the experience was just one of utter repose and bliss, just being completely one, no separation with the grasses, you know, the sky. It was quite a blissful experience, a good memory. And I've also had, you know, the experience at Hokioji, where you're practicing in nature, quite intimately close with nature, of a teaching poem's content coming alive. So I want to read you, I want to read you about, from Dogen, the sutra that inspired a direct experience for me of non-sentient beings expounding the Dharma. This is from Jijiyu Samadhi, which one translation of that, Japanese, is Samadhi of the Whole Self. So the whole body, mind, spirit. And Samadhi means complete immersion or oneness with. I won't read a lot, don't worry. It starts out like this. And they chant this, I was told, during Ongos in Japan every noon. I don't know, Edo, if you know, do they chant this at Romanji at noon during Ongos? Jijiyu Samadhi. Okay. It goes like this. All Buddhas directly transmit inconceivable Dharma and actualize perfect awakening by a wondrous unfabricated means whose touchstone is the Samadhi of the whole self. Sitting upright is a true gate to rejoicing in this Samadhi. Although this inconceivable Dharma is abundant to each person, it's not actualized without practice, and it's not attained without realization. The wholehearted endeavor of the way allows all things to come forth in awakening and practice all-inclusiveness. When you display the Buddha mudra with your whole body and mind, each and everything throughout the Dharma world is the Buddha mudra, and all space without exception is enlightenment. I won't read the whole thing, but this part. The land, trees and grasses, fences and walls, tiles and pebbles, all the various things in the ten directions carry out Buddha work, and everyone shares the benefits of these elemental forces. All are imperceptibly helped by the wondrous Buddha Dharma to awaken enlightenment. The trees, grasses, and land involved in this radiate a bright and shining light and bring forth the profound and inconceivable Dharma, and it is endless. Trees and grasses, walls and fences expound and exalt the Dharma for the sake of ordinary people, sages, and all living beings. Ordinary people, sages, and all living beings in turn expound and exalt the Dharma for the sake of trees, grasses, walls, and fences. The realm of self-awakening as awakening others is full of the characteristics of realization, and this realization continues without ceasing. So that is a beautiful, and it's longer, and there's more, but it keeps sort of, you know, circling around the same ideas and, you know, looking at the jewel from this facet and that facet. And I really have had the experience, and it was at Hokioji, and probably because I was doing a lot of sitting, you know, in a very beautiful place, that I could see that shining light coming from rocks and fences. And I'm sure you've maybe had some experience that's similar. So that is from the Bendoa, actually. It's found in the Bendoa. Dogen's Bendoa, and it's a glorious statement of what samadhi is. It's a song, and so you sing it together. And you can Google it and recite it if you like it, you know, on your own. You can find it. Various Zen centers online will have list their sutras in English translation, and you can work with that if you like it. You won't have to go to Japan to a monastery. So expounding Dharma is just a way to speak about wholehearted engagement in life. You know, and that doesn't involve complaint, apparently. You know? Take a tree. Trees have always been really potent symbols for me. You know, they stand through all weather. A lot of them are very flexible. They store up water in the roots for when they need it. They're giving all the time, offering shade, offering windbreak, offering protection. And you don't hear them complaining. At least I can't hear that, you know. It's they're just being, and their being is powerful, isn't it? You mean, have you ever been to the desert for any length of time and just like knew you were really missing something, you know, missing those trees or even the prairies. And in our tradition, in the Zen tradition, rocks and stones are really prominent. Remember all the stories Tim would tell us and that are in the books about Suzuki Roshi, how he loved to spend hours moving huge stones around, you know. And Japanese gardens are often stones and pebbles raked and arranged just so. And doing the arranging and the moving is being intimately connected to this non-sentient being that's part of expounding the Dharma. So how about ordinary objects like shoes? You know, sometimes we come into Zen Center and we see piles of shoes everywhere at the doorway, and that's probably because there aren't enough shelves to arrange them neatly. But Katagiri Roshi used to preach constantly about the importance of how you relate to everyday objects, and the most famous one was toilet paper. He took the most lowly thing he could think of that we would all overlook and talked about the importance of taking good care of the toilet paper. You know? Like, I went to my friend's temple one day at her house. She has a center in Iowa, and she was preparing to have a sesshin, and when you went in the bathroom, the toilet paper was folded into a little point, just like they do at hotels sometimes. I was very impressed. I felt kind of touched, you know. So, other than that they're an object of mindfulness for us, could there be any value in seeing just ordinary objects? Like for Guishan, it's a whisk. But for us, it might be a book. My friend, I know books are becoming obsolete, but my friend, I'm kind of hard on books, you know. I need to practice what I preach, definitely. And I don't really preach this, but Katagiri did. And my friend Nancy James, she just really reveres books. She has a great respect and reverence for books. And volunteered for her library in Florida for a long time, and you just feel that from her. And it gives me a great inspiration to be more mindful and careful around everyday activities. So I only got to one story, and we still have a little time, so I want to read just another encounter to you really quick. I think it's pretty self-explanatory, so it won't need too much explanation of Dongshan and Yunyan. He studied with Yunyan for quite some time, and there's obviously there was an intimacy there that was great. So one day he asks him, are there other practices I haven't completed? And Yunyan said, what were you doing before you came here? Dongshan said, I wasn't practicing the Noble Truths. Yunyan said, were you joyous in this non-practice? Dongshan said, it was not without joy. It's like sweeping excrement into a pile and then picking up a precious jewel from within it. Dongshan asked Yunyan, when I want to see it, face to face, what should I do? Yunyan said, ask someone who's done it. Dongshan said, that's what I'm doing. Yunyan said, what can I say to you? That's the whole thing. Don't you love it? I mean, you could just... I remember just wishing Tim would just really tell us what we were supposed to do. You know, just like tell us, you know. Why aren't you telling us? Why aren't you, you know? You're holding something back, aren't you? Why? You know. Kanagiri used to express his gratitude that his teacher didn't explain things to him. He found it really hard as a young man to be with that teacher who just went about his ordinary routine, always welcomed guests, was always even-handed. He didn't appreciate it till much later, he said. So Dongshan's now preparing to leave Yunyan. Yunyan said, where are you going? Dongshan said, although I'm leaving the master, I don't know where I'll end up. Yunyan said, you're not going to Hunan? Dongshan said, no, I'm not. Yunyan said, are you returning home? No. Yunyan said, sooner or later you'll return. Dongshan said, when the master has an abode, then I'll return. He's living in a cave, right? Yunyan said, if you leave, it will be difficult to see one another again. Dongshan said, it will be difficult to not see one another. And later, Dongshan said, everywhere he went, he saw, he met his master, he met Yunyan. Just when he was about to depart, he said, if in the future someone happens to ask whether I can describe the master's truth or not, how should I answer them? After a long pause, Yunyan said, just this is it. Dongshan sighed. Then Yunyan said, worthy Liang, now that you've taken on this great affair, you must consider it carefully. Dongshan continued to experience doubt. Later, as he crossed a stream, he saw his reflection in the water and was awakened to Yunyan's meaning. He then composed this verse. Avoid seeking elsewhere, for that's far from the self. Now I travel alone, everywhere I meet it. Now it's exactly me. Now I'm not it. It must thus be understood to merge with thusness. We'll read one last one. He was famous for saying when a monk asked him if how to escape the cold and the heat, his famous response was, let the cold kill you. Let the heat kill you. He didn't mean literally kill. Dongshan hosted a feast of commemoration on the anniversary of Yunyan's death. A monk asked, when you were at Yunyan's place, what teaching did he give you? Although I was there, I didn't receive any teaching. The monk asks, but you're holding a commemorative feast for the late teacher. Doesn't that show you approve his teaching? Half approve, half not approve. That's really how it is, you guys. If someone asked me about Tim, I'd say the same thing. Half approve, half not approve. That's actually a good way to express that. The monk said, why don't you completely approve of it? Dongshan said, if I completely approved, then I would be disloyal to my late teacher. So that's the official stories. There's also a story about when he dies. They hold a big feast for him before he dies. They sit around and before he dies, they're wailing. His disciples are wailing and crying, and he says, oh, geez, okay. So he sticks around for another week. He decides to stick around for another week, and he has them hold a feast for him. And once the feast is over, he says, okay, that's enough. He passes away in Zazen. So there's, some of these stories are... can't take them literally, but I hope that you got something from them today. And now I want to ask you those questions again, but I have to look at them because I can't remember them. Those original questions that I started with, and see if anyone wants to share a response. What would be the equivalent to actions beyond words, beyond speaking and reading for our time? How can we realize and demonstrate reality beyond duality of subject, object, self, and other in our daily activities and in our relationships? Anybody have any ideas to share with each other about that? I'm sure you do it. I'm sure you do it.
The question how inanimate objects can...
No, but there's another one.
Oh,
sorry. That's a good one. Here's another question then. You don't... About... Okay. How can we realize and demonstrate reality, the reality of our being, beyond the duality of subject-object, self and other, in daily activities and in our relationships? Can you think of just anything? Is the split between self and other just completely irreparable? Is there no way to bridge that? Are we doomed? I hope not.
But if we see someone, an old friend, each time, for the first time, without holding their past against them, holding something against them that they said that we got angry about, and in that way we free them from the past and we free our own mind.
Yeah, us, ourselves too. Yeah, thank you. Did you guys hear that? Wanda said, how about when we meet an old friend who... we're angry at about something they did, if we can just approach them, if we can let go of that and approach them anew, fresh. Is that it? Yeah. That's really good, I think. Yeah, that's really good. It's just as simple as that. It's not that easy, but it is as simple as that. That's really non-separation in relationship with someone else.
Were you thinking of an answer in words or not in words?
any answer. If it weren't in words, it would be fantastic.
And I think our culture teaches us that we're supposed to know the answers. And so being open, understanding that there are so many layers, that there's so much that we can't know. And I think our science is coming to that, really.
Yeah.
We don't stop at the end of our skin. I'd love to talk so much. There was this rich and deep and full of that, those examples of don't know mind.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a really good point. If you're full of these stories and you're just like, what? You can think about what Pamela just said. You know, just don't know mind. Dropping expectations. So much of our suffering has to do with both believing we're all alone or separate, and also being just caught in our ideas, unable to flow. Because Dogen says mountains are walking and reality flows. That these things that look static, including ourselves, are actually always in flow and in flux. And I think that's what you're referring to, that science is... Kadagiri used to say, science, hurry up. Like, hurry up and wake up, science is catching up with us. Okay, anybody else? Oh, hi.
Well, I was thinking Wanda was mentioning, and if you are very mindful and in the moment, and you can operate in that moment and be very mindful, then all the other stuff, the memories of a person in the past, the problems are not really part of it.
Right. If we can be in just this, which is not easy for us, but I find it definitely healing, you know, that the present moment awareness, just this, is quite healing. It heals that separation, relieves us of the burden of our constant commentary and our stories and grudges. And, you know, if we keep at it. Yeah. Yep. He said we could view everyone we encounter as an old friend, but freshly, right? Yeah, that's a good idea.
I like to think of expressing non-duality in my life, that's expressed through the practice of generosity, and how, you know, in living day to day, you know, it's like I'm taking all the time, taking a breath, taking a drink, you know, taking a meal, and to turn that around and give, to me, expresses non-duality. And if I really accept non-duality, I'm really giving to myself.
Right, so then giving and receiving simultaneously is non-dual, right? Because you're already alive, you're already here, you have every right to receive all the same benefits we all receive. The air and the water, earth, fire, the beauty, nourishment. So you have, that's just your natural endowment. But to know that and then be able to look for chances to give to others, you know, to be generous, that's great. That's where I find myself falling down sometimes. And I don't know if I have a clear vision of myself, but I'll kind of check that, you know. Am I clinging or am I able to just open my hands and be generous? That's kind of a good check for us. Hato.
This morning I had an experience of the inanimate object expounding the Dharma. And that was when I wake up in the morning, but when I woke up this morning, I didn't want to get up. And this is not uncommon. And I have a tendency towards depression. So it's like no matter how good life is, I still might not want to meet it. But, you know, it's just almost like part of my nature, unfortunately. So one of the things I do is I try to, when I notice this, start practicing gratitude. But in this case, this morning, I got up because I was going someplace.